Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Chin-Yang Lee, professor and the founding director of the philosophy program at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore, and author of The Confucian Philosophy of Harmony. He'll speak on the topic Care and Justice in Confucian Ethics, Reading Mencius, Kant, and Gilligan Comparatively. This program, part of the 12th Asian Culture Week, sponsored by Creighton's Asian World Center, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, April 21st, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to speak on the topic Care and Justice in Confucian Ethics is Chin-Yang Lee.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Maureen, for inviting me. And thank you, everyone, for coming this afternoon. It's a great honor to come here. I shortened the title a little bit. The content is the same as listed on your brochure. Over the years, one strain of my work has been on Confucian ethics and care ethics. In this paper, I'm going to discuss the element of care and element of justice in Confucian ethics and how the configuration of these two values identify or characterize Confucian ethics as a species of ethics. Ever since the early 90s, philosophers started talking about comparative issues with Confucian ethics and care ethics. Along with that discussion, there have also been discussion about Confucian ethics and justice ethics and Confucian ethics and virtue ethics. Most of you probably already are familiar with care ethics, justice ethics, and virtue ethics to some degree. Basically, I use them here to refer three species of ethical thought. Care ethics covers some key ideas about how to be ethical. Basically, you have to rely on human relationships and to have a caring disposition to others, and you have obligation to people who are in close relationship with you, and that kind of idea you will find in care ethics. Justice ethics, more or less, in comparison, focuses on moral principles, on universal moral principles that we all should follow, and focus on impartiality in your ethical conduct. You should not be partial to anyone, including people in close relationship with you. And the virtue ethics basically focus on the idea that ethics is primarily developing personal virtues. You are a nice person. You're a good person, you have all these good virtues. You are kind, caring, and you are diligent in your work and polite in your behavior, etc., etc. And of course, you are wise and intelligent and others kind of knowledgeable, similar virtues. Confucian ethics focuses on the making of a moral personhood by developing virtues in constructing and improving human relationships. Now, Confucians literally believe that when we talk about the concept of person or human, it's not something you are born with. It's something you develop. You grow into. So you are not really born a full human being in a moral sense. you have to go through moral cultivation to learn with from others, to gradually improve yourself and become a person of humanity in that sense. And in doing so, you build human relationships. And in a family, you learn, you know, from your parents, from your elder siblings. When you get older, you take care of your younger siblings. You develop a sense of responsibility. And then beyond the family, you make friends, you know your neighbor, and you develop a relationship with them. So in this whole process, you become a moral person. There are a few key concepts in Confucian ethics. One is the concept of ren. Some of you probably are in Asia studies class already learned this. It has been translated as benevolence or humanity, care, etc., etc. Basically, it's the kind of a high-level virtue we develop. And we become a person who care about others, who have a good sense of how to handle things, how to do things, how to go about things in the world. So it's a kind of virtue concept. Now, side by side with the concept of ren, you will find the notion of li. Li is translated into many things. It is a rather comprehensive concept. It has to do with social norms, etiquette, and protocol. Basically, when you think about it, when you are a toddler, you need to learn things how to do. Your mother, your teacher, you know, tells you, now you can use it to share your toy with others. So being able to share your toy, that is kind of a li, to be nice to others. And this kind of thing usually comes with a certain norms, rules to follow. You should not do certain things. You should do certain things. So these are covered by the concept of li. And here I render it as a ritual of propriety. Then along with this, we also have the notion in Confucianism, the concept of yi. Yi, there are different translations. Very broadly means doing things appropriately, but mostly in the sense closely related in Western philosophy, closely related to morality, moral things, doing it right. And so often translated uprightness, moral, follow moral principles. Sometimes you have to risk yourself to bear the burden of a certain cost just to make things right. And that is the notion of yi. Now, these notions, I think, is not that alien to anybody in any part of the world. We just don't really characterize them, don't conceptualize them the same way as the Confucians have done. The sciences, I think, is not that alien to anyone. Now, when we compare Confucian ethics with care ethics, one question has been raised is that since the Confucian ethics embrace both ren and yi, whether Confucian ethics should be considered similar to care ethics or similar to justice ethics. Now, in care ethics, you develop a personality of a caring disposition. You develop a relationship. So you learn to be nice, to be humane, to be good to others. That's kind of overlap with the notion of ren. In justice ethics, there is a focus on moral principles, universalized moral principles. What is right is important. So it's appears that you can find both elements in Confucian ethics, then the question is, what do these two elements do on how we characterize Confucian ethics? Some scholars have argued, based on these two features, argue that Confucian ethics actually integrate both care ethics and justice ethics. You find both ethics in Confucian ethics. Here I'm going to argue that although Confucian ethics embraces both care and justice, but it does not integrate the two ethics of care ethics and justice ethics. In comparison with care ethics and justice ethics, Confucian ethics is more like care ethics than it is like justice ethics. Now, in doing this, I differentiate between care and justice as individual values on the one hand, and care ethics and justice ethics as ethical systems on the other hand. I'm going to explain this difference. Towards the end of this, the second half of presentation, I'm also going to try to present some difficult cases in Confucian ethics and see whether we can make sense of it in a different way. Now, when people talk about Confucian ethics and care and justice, they often use the term perspectives. Perspectives is a vague term. When we talk about care perspectives, justice perspectives, you can mean different things. You can mean care as individual value, and you can also mean care ethics. Or you can mean justice as individual value, or you can also mean justice ethics. And these are very different. Let me give you an example. Imagine a team of students with the assignment from their professors to make an airplane model. And you are given a budget, and you can make the airplane model as you design it. Now, the material you have to buy through that fixed budget, each group, each team, has been given. Now, imagine this team has to decide whether you buy the airplane model frame, the structure, the frame, from a shop, or you make it from a raw material, from, you know, scratch, from parts. And if you buy it, buy the frame, then you can put other things, put the propeller, put the engine, put the wheel on, and the decoration, put those on. And that will be more efficient for you to make the model. It takes less time to make the frame, right? But when you do that, it incurs a higher cost, right? You go to the shop to buy a frame, they're going to charge you. So it costs more. Now, here, if you think about it from the perspective of efficiency, it's better to buy the frame. It'll give you a lead in a competition, for example, to move forward. But if you make the frame yourself from, you know, metal, raw metal material, it will save you money. You use the budget, the money to buy perhaps a more efficient motor or something better to make other parts better. So from these two perspectives, from efficiency, it's better to buy the frame. From the perspective of economy, it's better to make it from scratch. So that's When we talk about single aspect perspectives, these are two different perspectives. Now imagine team members disagree on how to go about it. Suppose there are two team members. Team member A thinks it's better just to buy the frame, then move fast, spend more time later on designing the rest of the model. However, team member B wanted to make the frame themselves. And then they use the extra money to buy other parts, buy a better motor for the engine. Now there, they also have different perspectives. The second case, I call them configured perspectives. Team member A thinks efficiency is more important than economy in that decision, on that decision. And team member B thinks economy is more important than efficiency at that point. So they configure these two differently in their choices. They do not disagree on if more efficient to buy the frame and more economical to make the frame themselves. They do not disagree on that. But they disagree which one is more important, which one should they prioritize. In the latter case, they disagree in the sense of a configured perspective. Now, what is the relevance of this example? I'm going to argue that when we talk about the care and the justice as individual values, they are comparable to efficiency and economy. When you talk about the care ethics and the justice ethics, they are comparable to the latter part of the story, on configured perspectives. That means that in ethics, single aspect perspective like economy or efficiency in the example are moral values. They provide directions and guidelines for our action. You will find similar moral values in a variety of ethical systems. However, when we talk about ethics as ethical systems, we are talking about configured perspectives. They prioritize these individual values differently. That is to say, in this case, by and large, in care ethics, values associated with care are prioritized more. In comparison, in justice ethics, by and large, values associated with justice are prioritized more. Now, why there is a need for prioritizing values? Because values compete. When you pursue values, you have to decide often when they compete which one you prioritize. Sometimes they conflict. Like the example of the airplane models. Imagine you are on a team. You feel strongly you need to move fast to get the frame, get this part done. You focus on how to design the engine and the rest of the part. But your teammate think we don't have much money. We cannot afford this frame. We will not have enough money for other things. So let's make the frame ourselves. There, you two configure these values differently. Similarly, in ethics, there is also an issue of configuration. And different ethics prioritize similar values in different orders. Now, what is the proof of that? You can find many proofs in traditional ethical systems, by which I mean Confucian ethics, Buddhist ethics, Christian ethics, utilitarian ethics, justice ethics. These are all I call ethical systems, system of values, system of theory, theoretical systems. One example is that if you compare ancient China and ancient Japan, you can both find the value of filial love. That is your moral duty to your parents and ancestors, on the one hand, and your duty to the ruler, the emperor, or the state, the country, on the other hand. You find both values. But when these two values come to conflict, often you find the Chinese tend to put the filial love at a higher place than value their loyalty to the state or to the emperor. In comparison, Japanese tend to put loyalty to the emperor higher than your obligation to your parents. In ancient China, for example, individuals' obligation to the emperor is already very important, very high. But a person can always decline an emperor's call to serve in his court, royal court, by the excuse that I have aged parents at home. You know, they live in remote area from the capital. I cannot move them to the capital. Therefore, my filial obligation requires me to stay with my aged parents. Therefore, I cannot serve your majesty. That was usually acceptable. And that shows there is, you know, different ranking. In Japan, from what I have read, often that excuse are less likely to be accepted. So even though they value both, you find this. And you find other examples. Often I tell my students, in the West, they also value honoring your parents. It's not that only Chinese do or the Confucians do. But in comparison, you will find the Chinese value is higher than the Christian people in the Christian tradition, for example. Well, Christian tradition values, you know, loving your neighbor more than most Chinese do. It's not like, you know, either does not value those. They value both. It's just the, when there's a compete on your energy, on your action, they configure them differently. Now, let me give you a specific example in Confucian philosophy. Mencius is a major thinker in the Confucian tradition. He is the thinker second only to Confucius. Actually, in terms of his philosophical contribution, many people would even consider him to be making a larger philosophical contribution than Confucius. Even though he followed Confucius, but in terms of elaboration, developing thought, ideas, he probably has more to offer. In one of his conversations with someone, there was an issue of whether the Confucian sage king by the name of Shun, he was a, you know, a role model in the Confucian tradition. He was an emperor, but he was also a very filial son to his parents, etc., etc. But the question was raised, given that Shun was so dedicated to his role as the emperor, it was impossible for him to attend as much to his own parents as an ordinary citizen, ordinary subject would. Then the challenge is that did he really fulfill his moral filial obligation to his parents? I think on the face of it, he probably did not. You know, imagine you are the president of the United States. You're busy with many important, urgent things every day. You love your parents, but you don't have as much time for them. That's just a basic fact, right? Now, here, what is interesting in this example is that Mencius wanted to defend Emperor Shun, but he did not say, you know, serving the country is more important. Rather, he said, instead, you honor your parents by serving the country as an emperor is the greatest honor a son can give to his parents. Now, what that implies is that by serving his country, Shun was fulfilling his filial obligation. Right? We may disagree with the Mencius' characterization, but what is clear here is that clearly he's using filial love as a higher value in justifying Shun's action. Otherwise, he would have said, you know, it's more important to serve your country, period. He did not do that. That means he actually valued filial obligation. Now, filial obligation is more associated with the cluster of notion of care rather than justice. Now, what is the proof of this claim? Let me show you. Carol Gilligan is a representative of care ethics. Her most known work is in A Different Voice, where she proposed that women, by and large, not necessarily all women, is not based on sex. It's that kind of a theme-based observation, tended to regard ethical behavior in terms of care, being preserving human relationships. And her study on rights and responsibility gives us many stories about this. For example, Amy, one of her study subjects, was torn between, going with the notion of justice and preserving her friendship with another girl. And, Amy was kind of caught in between for that. Another kind of example that shows what Gilligan here has to say, that for women, the integration of rights and responsibilities, which is more kind of a care notion towards your friends, your family, your loved ones, your students, take place through the understanding of the psychological logic of a relationship. This understanding tempers the self-destructive potential of self-critical morality by asserting the need of all persons for care. For men, recognition through experience of the need for the more active responsibility in taking care corrects the potential indifference of morality of non-interference and turns attention from the logic to the consequences of choice. Okay. So you can find both gender incorporate these similar elements. So it's not that a man are one way entirely without care and a care entirely without justice. And she made it clear by saying it is not that women are blind to justice, it is rather that women brings to the life cycle a different point of view and order human experience in terms of different priorities. That is the difference. That's the difference. So the kind of characterization of care ethics as ethics focused solely on relationships, on care, entirely without consideration to justice, is not accurate. It's not accurate. Now we take a look at the typical representative of justice ethics, Immanuel Kant. Kant usually is interpreted as focusing solely on practical rationality, not on sentiment at all. That means you follow our moral principle only, not thinking about how you should care about others. But if you read Kant carefully, that is not the case. In Metaphysics of Morals, Kant says, while it is not itself a duty to share the sufferings as well as the joy of others, It is a duty to sympathize actively in their fate. To this end, it is therefore an indirect duty to cultivate the compassionate, natural, aesthetic feelings in us, and to make use of them as so many means to sympathy based on moral principles and the feelings appropriate to them. It is therefore a duty not to avoid the place where the poor who lack the most basic necessities are to be found, but rather to seek them out, and not to shun sick rooms and debtors' prisons and so forth in order to avoid sharing painful feelings one may not be able to resist. For this is still one of the impulses that nature has implanted in us, to do what the representation of the duty alone may not accomplish. So in acting morally, we need both moral principles and this kind of moral sentiment that helps us to carry out of our moral duty. Okay. However, Kant is not saying both are equally important. That makes him a justice ethicist rather than a care ethicist. He said in the Critique of Practical Reason, he has no kind of a feeling, even under the name of practical or moral feelings, may be assumed as prior to the moral law and as its basis. Moral feelings does not serve for an estimate of actions or as a basis of the objective moral law itself, but only as an incentive to make this law itself a maxim. In other words, you should develop moral sentiment to be sympathetic to others. Basically, you have to care about others. It's good to care about others. However, that should not be the foundation, not be the key part of your moral self. Your moral self fundamentally still has to be the moral law, which comes from reason, from rationality. So you can see here, he configures the two elements very differently from the way Carol Gilligan did, right? Now let's move on to Confucian ethics. We have discussed the care ethics and the justice ethics as two configured perspectives. Each configure both care and justice, but configure them differently, prioritize different elements within each system. Now we move to Confucian ethics. In Confucian ethics, you can also find care-associated values on the one hand and justice-associated values on the other. The question is how we characterize overall Confucian ethics. Now, let me introduce a very controversial passage in the Book of Mencius. Now, Mencius in the Confucian tradition was rarely challenged by Confucian thinkers. But for this passage, he was actually challenged not only by non-Confucians, but by some Confucian thinkers as well. Now, what is the passage here? Here, he was engaged in a conversation with a man by the name of Tao Ying. Tao Ying was very persistent. He tried to push the envelope, to press Mencius hard, to deal with very difficult moral dilemmas. Now, Tao Ying asked, when Shun, remember Shun, he was the emperor sage king, supposed to be a perfect moral model for everyone. When he was the emperor and Gao, Shun's appointee, was the judge. You think about that, the Attorney General of the United States, the man in charge of all these judicial affairs. If the blind man killed a man, the blind man is the father of Shun. Shun's father was blind, and he has a kind of designation as the blind man. Suppose he killed a man, killed someone else. What is to be done? First of all, the case itself is provocative. You are talking about a sage king, perfect person in a Confucian personality. Suddenly, his father was going to kill someone for nothing. That makes his father a murderer, right? And so Mencius responded by saying, the only thing was to apprehend him, get him arrested. And Tao Ying asked, in that case, would Shun stop it? Shun was the emperor. He has all the power. And the minister said, how could Shun stop it? Gao, the judge, had authority for what he did. That was his job. Gao's job was to arrest, you know, criminals. Then Tao Ying said, come on, what should Shun do? He's a father. And at that point, Mencius, apparently he was reluctant to spell it out. Finally, he had to say it. He said, Shun looked upon casting aside the empire as no more than discarding a worn shoe. He would have secretly carried the old man on his back and fled to the edge of the sea and lived there happily, never giving a thought to the empire. Let me analyze this scenario in different steps. I want to show that this example, I will take two steps. One, I want to show this example provides evidence that Confucian ethics is more like a care ethics. It puts the filial love, the personal relationship, higher than justice. Second step, I'm going to try to make sense of whether we can, you know, have a kind of a sympathetic understanding of it or not. So the first step is we can analyze this story in two steps, in the five steps. First, clearly we are talking about a struggle between pursuing filial love, your filial love to your parents on the one hand, and then justice. A man was murdered. Society needed to maintain order. That's clearly associated with justice, right? Now, if you imagine Mencius as a Confucian thinker had only advocated filial love, but not justice at all, Mencius would have said Shun should use his power to stop the prosecution right away, right? Forget about the justice. This is my father. Set him free, right? But Mencius did not say that. Therefore, it's not the case that he had only filial love in mind, but no justice at all. Second possibility, if Mencius had only advocated justice, but not filial love, he would have said Shun should fully support the state prosecution of his father just as one else, and do nothing else. Period. That's it. But he did not stop there. He did not say that either. Now imagine, this is probably not likely, but imagine Mencius advocate both filial love and justice equally, absolutely equal, in equal terms. 50-50. Theoretically, he would court right in between. Like the story of Braden's ass. Have you heard the story? It's a story that this very rational donkey caught it between two piles of hay, delicious hay, with equal amount, equally fresh, in equal distance. So the ass cannot come up with a rational reason to start from this pile first or that pile first. Whatever reason he can give to start this pile applies equally well to start with that pile. So he cannot make a rational decision. In the end, he starves to death. Right. But that really does not happen, really. Right? And the ministers, if he were 50-50, strictly speaking, he would call in between. I don't know. Right? But he did not end there. So it's not that case. Fourth, if he advocated both filial love and justice, but more justice than filial piety, he would have said that Shun should support the civil prosecution of his father while using less drastic ways to show care for his father. He probably brings his father, go to visit his father in the jail and bring good food to his father or just do something other thing nice to his father, but not take his father secretly out of jail and go on exile. But he did not do that either. Instead, if he advocated both, and but he advocated more filial love than justice, he would have done things. On the one hand, let the state proceed with a prosecution. On the other hand, in an attempt to fulfill his duty as a filial son, he would secretly get his father out and escape justice. So this is the five scenarios in summary. And from this example, you can see that in his mind, the way he configured different values, he has both filial love, which is associated with the care, on the one hand, and the justice on the other. But he configured them clearly in a way that when the two comes to conflict, care is more important than justice. That shows my argument that Confucian ethics, even though it incorporates both care and justice, as ethics is more like care ethics than it is like justice ethics. It does not integrate both care ethics and justice ethics as the two configurations of values. It integrated two values, but not two ethics value systems. So we draw a line from there. Now, probably you're not a surprise that even Confucians are divided on this issue. Over history, Chinese thinkers have raised objections. One example is the Su Zhe in the 11th century, a well-known literary person and a thinker. And many, of course, many contemporary thinkers, both Confucian and non-Confucian, feel very uncomfortable about this. Some are trying to justify it, saying, well, in ancient time, you cannot have hired lawyers, there may not be a fair trial, and they would cane the suspect right away until you admit your guilt, then they will put you to death trying to justify it. But still, the issue is still there. And there are also thinkers who are in full support of measures. And one example is Yang Shi. Yang Shi says that in this case, releasing someone who has committed murder abrogates the law, which is not good. Executing his father injures what he owes for his father's kindness in raising him. The point is that there is not a day when society can be without the law, and there is not a day when the son can sacrifice his father. However, the people can always find a ruler. Therefore, Shun lets the court, the royal court, prosecute his father in order to uphold the law for society, and he secretly carries his father on exile in order to repay his father's kindness. In doing so, Shun is able to fulfill his duty on both sides. But you cannot help asking, does Shun really fulfill his duty on both sides? His duty to the state, to society, and his duty to his father. And that is rather controversial. Personally, I don't think he did or he would be able to. I think in this case, there is no perfect solution. Even though most of us moderns today would probably not secretly carry our father away from the jail and go on exile, we probably, you know, sell our house to pay a good lawyer to at least give our father a good chance. But the sentiment is still there. I want to recognize that the legitimacy of that sentiment. If you look at 60 Minutes of 2020, this kind of program, often they carry this story about, you know, husband is accused of murdering his wife and the father, mother, daughter, or wow, mother. And then you will find families are immediately divided. Usually, not surprisingly, the victim family are united against the accused, and the accused family often hold a strong belief of the innocence of the accused. Even after the court ruled that the jury decided that the man is guilty or the woman is guilty, for that matter, but their family has, you know, strong solidarity to the accused. Now, I don't want to simply trash this sentiment. I think this sentiment is the same sentiment we hold dearly in us to make us good people, good family member, good friends in society, good colleagues. Okay. So how to make sense of it? I don't agree that there is a perfect solution you can actually fulfill both duties. I want to make sense of this, not just saying that, you know, your duty to your father is higher, therefore it's okay to help your father escape justice. Okay. I want to make sense, and at least make some sense of this, by introducing or borrowing the idea of tragedy from the German philosopher Hegel. Hegel developed this notion of tragedy by reading Greek tragedies. He argues that the original essence of tragedy, the crucial element, the nature of tragedy, consists of when, in the fact that within such a conflict, there is a conflict of two things. Each of the opposing sides, if taken by itself, has justification. While on the other hand, each can establish the true and positive content of its own aim and character only by negating and damaging the equally justified power of the other. What it means in plain language is that in a tragic case, what you see is not the good opposed the bad, the evil. The right opposed the wrong. Rather, you will find two just forces, two good forces, two legitimate forces. They are each legitimate on its own, but they come into conflict. There is a clash between the two. And you cannot preserve both. And that is why it is tragic. In that sense, it's not the way we often use tragic in very broadly. You know, a little baby is killed, it's tragic. We see that. But here, in a term of the philosophical tragedy, here we're talking about two rightful forces on their legitimate tracks clash. When they clash, they cannot come out intact both ways. One has to be sacrificed, or both will be ruined. And we do experience or observe this kind of tragic case in real life. Now, not every conflict is tragic. Okay, you have to decide to come to this talk this afternoon or go to a party, it's dilemma, it's a time conflict. But whichever you decide, it's not tragic. When it's tragic, we talk about it's, when we talk about issues of large magnitude and important and with grave consequences, and that when is when we consider it tragic. Now let me give you an example of you know, some tragic cases. The American writer Edward Foster once wrote in his Two Cheers for Democracy, he famously said, "If I had to choose between betraying my country and betraying my friend, I hope I should have the guts to betray my country." I think this is an example of a tragic. Most of us will not go that far to betray our country. That's a treason, right? And it takes a lot of guts to go for your friend against your country. Now, we may not agree with him. If someone betrays his country for his friend, we may not agree with that person. But we still, I think if you think about it, you still have to respect that sentiment that person share. In this case, suppose it really, it did not happen actually, it's just saying so. Suppose it really happened. You still have to feel a sense of respect for this person to betray his country in order to protect his friend. So that is a valuable sentiment, even though some people may argue misplaced, but still respectable sentiment. Another example, typical example, is in the Greek tragedy Antigone. Some of you are already familiar with that. In a story, Antigone's brother was killed because he rebelled against his own city-state, his own country. The king ordered his corpse not to be buried, to be exposed in the public square as a punishment for his treason. His treason. Antigone is caught in between. On the one hand, this is his her brother and killed with his body exposed in public, without a proper burial. On the other hand, is the state, the law, issued from the king, not to bury the body. So what should she do? Either way, she has to negate something that is legitimate in order to fulfill one of her obligations, either to her family or to her state. And people may have a different choice in that scenario. Her sister, Ismene, chose to obey the law of the state rather than burying her brother's body. Antigone chose differently. Antigone chose to bury her brother in violation of the law of the state. And she realized you cannot have both, and the two rightful forces, two moral demand, clash. She had to choose, and he did. Now, I think if you think that way, you may still not agree with the measures, but you probably will develop more sense of sympathy and respect for the sentiment, the idea behind the solution measures provide for that hypothetical situation. And measures is aware of moral dilemmas. In one passage, he said that fish is what I want. Bear's palm is also what I want. If I cannot have both, I would rather take bear's palm than fish. Life is what I want. Moral rightness is also what I want. If I cannot have both, I would rather take moral rightness than life. Now, bear's palm was and probably is, still is, a Chinese delicacy. Nowadays, good Chinese don't eat it anymore because, you know, it's for environmental concerns, so animal welfare. But it's considered highly valuable in Chinese cuisine, at least it used to be. Now, you want both dishes. You desire both dishes. But if you have only to choose one, you have to make a decision which one to go. And the mentioned use example to show that moral rightness, our moral obligation, is more valuable than life. So you need to choose to do the right, morally right thing. And in this specific example of Shrin's father, I assume Mencius thought fulfilling the moral obligation to his father is more important than to the state. So in conclusion, Confucian ethics embraces both care and justice as two individual values, as two single aspect perspectives. But it does not embrace both care ethics and justice ethics. It is not, therefore, appropriate to say Confucian ethics provide a perfect balance between care ethics and justice ethics. Actually, Confucian ethics is more like care ethics than it likes justice ethics. Confucian ethicists are like care ethicists, are willing to pay more in justice than justice ethicists are in order to preserve family relationships. And finally, as I explained towards the end, the second part of the paper, that when care and justice clashes, the idea of a tragic may help us make sense of a costly choice between the two. Again, only when major stake is involved, that we can use the notion of the tragic to help understand a decision which is costly but has to be made. With that, I conclude my talk. Thank you so much for listening.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Chenyang Li, professor and the founding director of the philosophy program at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore, and author of The Confucian Philosophy of Harmony. He spoke on the topic Care and Justice in Confucian Ethics, reading Mencius, Kant, and Gilligan comparatively. This program, part of the 12th Asian Culture Week, sponsored by Creighton's Asian World Center, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, April 21st, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, and Maorong Jiang, Director of the Asian World Center, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Coate, thanking you for listening.